After Dark, we're back. With our eyes wide shut. We're back
smoking
with
that,
our eyes.
Smoking that shit that's got our eyes wide shut. With
instant classic. Ah. Yeah. And then in the little bit in Telegram that we did not record, but which Patreon people should get to hear. First, thank you. We appreciate it. Thank you for supporting the pod. Please continue to do it. The way this works is we have a good month. We bring a bunch of new patrons on board. And as long as everybody stays on the ship and comes with us, it stacks month over month. The pod grows. People start to go, hey, wait a minute. There's something going on. These guys are getting support from real people. It's got that crowdfunding quality. It's a word I kind of hate. You're not the crowd, but like, you know, it's got that quality of, I guess they call it social proof, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
You know, it is. It's so hard to cut through the noise. There's so much content and so much garbage. Your vote of like, dollars on the line, like on the table, it really means a lot to us.
And it means also to, you know, one thing we're saying too, it means we can get bigger guests. We haven't been refused for many guest invitations, but there's been a couple of them where you're like, you know what, if we were twice the size we are, they probably would have said yes. So maybe not, who knows, but there's an element of that too. I think, you know, with the more support, the show's going to get better too. Just all around, we're going to have more time. We're going to, you know,
we're going to
be able to do things we couldn't do before. So,
and I've personally spoken to Death, and Death guarantees that bigger and bigger celebrities will die the more patrons we get, so we can get to more interesting I'm totally kidding you. I take it back. We are not wishing death upon anybody. We genuinely, even when we find our subjects to be monstrous and difficult, like Stanley Kubrick at times could be monstrous and difficult, we do try to approach all of these biographies, these profiles, we do out of like a place of like love, kind of love for our fellow man. What is it? Agape? Is that the word, Brad?
Yeah.
We got a lot of agape.
Yeah. That's kind of part of the thesis too, right? Is some of these people some of them did monstrous things. Certainly a lot of the monstrous things happened to them. I'm doing this Conrad research right now, and I'm not going to give anything away, but he was noted for his pessimism often. And he was talking to a writer friend of his, and he basically said, you know, you're a pessimist too. You hate people and think that they should be improved. I love people and think that they can't be improved. That was Conrad's attitude. And I think that's an interesting distinction, right?
Wow.
He loved them for what they were, you know? So there's a little bit of that too. It's like, we're not going to pretend that all of these people are flawless and perfect.
No.
So
nobody alive who's ever done anything interesting has failed at one point to be a monster.
Right.
We wrestle with it as part of our human nature, which is where the art comes from. Yeah. I've got the beginning of Arthur Schnitzler's dream story, Traumnovelle.
The first sentence is an eyebrow raiser.
Yeah, why don't I read a little bit of it here for the After Dark, and then I want to talk a little bit about this article I have from the set of it. Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Well, this was of a time. This is for the Patreon. This is for the After Dark. I'd forgotten about this.
I found a free PDF and I started reading it. And I like had to double check. And I'm like, am I reading the right book? Like what?
Okay. Well, listen, you paid your Patreon dollars. Now you can cancel me and destroy my life. No, this is the book. This is what it's based on. Please don't cancel me and destroy my life. 24 brown-skinned slaves rode the splendid galley, which was to bring Prince Amgiad to the palace of the caliph. The prince, wrapped in his purple cloak, lay alone on the deck under the dark blue starry sky, and his gaze. So far, the little girl had read aloud. Then suddenly her eyelids drooped. Her parents looked at each other and smiled. Fridolin bent down, kissed her blonde hair, and closed the book, which was lying on the untidy table. The child looked up as if caught at some mischief. It's 9 o'clock, her father said, and time you were in bed. Albertina also bent over her, and as her hand met her husband's on the beloved forehead, they looked at each other with a tender smile not meant for the child. The governess entered. Oh, the governess is back, mm-hmm. Brad. We've got mm-hmm. a governess on the pod. The governess entered and asked the little girl to say goodnight. She got up obediently, kissed her father and mother, and walked out quietly, hand in hand, with the young woman. Fridolin and Albertina, left alone under the reddish glow of the hanging lamp, continued the conversation they had begun before supper. It dealt with their experiences the night before at the masquerade ball. They had decided to attend it just before the end of the carnival period, as their first one of the season. No sooner had Fridolin entered the ballroom than he was greeted like a long-lost friend by two women in red dominoes. Domino. Mm-hmm. From the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He had no idea who they were, although they were unusually well-informed about many affairs of his student days and internship. They had invited him into a box with great friendliness, but had left again with the promise that they would soon return without masks. Mm. When they did not appear, he became impatient and went down to the ballroom floor, hoping to meet them again. But eagerly, as he scanned the room, he could not see them anywhere. Instead, however, another woman unexpectedly took his arm. It was his wife. She had just freed herself from the company of a stranger whose blasé manner and apparently Polish accent had at first charmed her. Suddenly, he had offended her, frightened her by a rather common and impertinent remark. Fridolin and Albertina were glad to have escaped from a disappointingly commonplace masquerade prank and soon sat like two lovers among the other couples in the buffet, eating oysters and drinking champagne. They chatted gaily as though they had just made each other's acquaintance, acting a comedy of courting, bashful resistance, seduction, and surrender. After driving home quickly through the snowy winter night, they sank into each other's arms and were more blissful in their ardent love than they had been for a long time. The gray of morning awakened them only too soon. Fridolin's profession summoned him to his patients at an early hour, while Albertina would not stay in bed longer because of her duties as housewife and mother. So the ensuing hours passed, soberly and predetermined, in daily routine and work, and the events of the night before, both those at the beginning and at the end, had faded. And it goes on like this. Kubrick had the ability to take a story and just crack it wide open, get to the marrow, get what he needed out of it, and make it his own. Yeah, there's something admirable about it. And in so many funny ways, why would he even need to option this?
Yeah, like, there is. They're right.
Nobody's going to know. Like, it's fine. I mean, sure.
Other people have ripped stuff off more egregiously and not given the nod to the source material. Right.
It makes sense that he would operate that way. And yet, mm-hmm. yeah, just very curious. Do you have something for the After Dark, Brad? Because if not, I have some, some links and things.
Yeah. I mean, I got a couple things. One is I was reading some various sort of critical writings on the film and, kind of pulling out some snippets, and so these are kind of maybe a little bit disconnected, but I thought they were sort of interesting. So one is on Kubrick's sentiment and politics, according to people close to him. So when Eyes Wide Shut was coming out, Kubrick asked Michael Herr, who co-wrote Full Metal Jacket, to write the sort of puff piece for Eyes Wide Shut, and in this piece. Which ended up being kind of the director's obituary as it came out in Vanity Fair. He says something about Kubrick's sensibility, which I just thought was a little bit of an addition to the core episode and a little bit of thinking about what Kubrick was like at the end of his life. Michael here says about Kubrick, quote, he was just an old-fashioned social Darwinist, seemingly, with layer upon layer of the old, now vanishing liberal humanism. Disappointed but undimmed and without contradiction. His views on democracy were that those of most people I know, neither left nor right, not exactly brimming with belief, a noble failed experiment along our evolutionary way, brought low by base instincts, money, and self-interest, and stupidity. I just thought that was interesting to think of him as not particularly radicalized in any way politically, or I mean, he's really sort of a craftsman, right? And there would be a way, like, you know how we get a lot of like celebrities now, and Kubrick, obviously he didn't play to being a celebrity, but he was a known figure, people knew him, and he's in that world of celebrity as a great director. There's this impulse that they have to all come out now and say the right thing about the current thing, right? You have to come out and you have to say, oh, we stand with this people, or we stand against this thing. Like, and I like this feeling of Kubrick as sort of the last man standing, who, you know, maybe didn't need to have a friggin' opinion about everything because the work stands for itself, you know? Yeah.
I love that this film is a rabbit hole that you can, I'm poking around at some of the articles that I've drummed up earlier, and I'm looking at them and I'm going, we don't have time to go into all of this.
Right. You know, what's funny is in the lead up to this episode, I have been revisiting it, disconnected, not for any particular reason for this episode. I've been re-listening to the great, like 6-hour, 3-part Martyr Made episodes on Jeffrey Epstein. And you listen to that, and then you get, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's got some questions about the Epstein situation. Martyr Made does a very deep dive, fair, I'm not going to say unbiased because nobody's unbiased, but fairly objective look at this stuff. And you listen to that, and then you come to this, and you're like, oh, what the guys were up to in Eyes Wide Shut is tame compared to what might actually be happening out there. This is it's all ceremonial and ritualistic, and there are rules, and there are like, you're like, this seems kind of like, you know, people want to hire some prostitutes and dress up in robes. I mean, really, is that big of a deal? You know what I mean?
Compared to some of
the stuff that seems to have actually been going on with the Jeffrey Epstein thing.
Oh, so, I mean, the Epstein thing is such a deep, dark hole. It's so demoralizing when you think about what it really could potentially mean. Mm-hmm. If you really want to go and get conspiratorial and start to think about compromat and double agents and three-letter agencies using that in order to affect foreign policy.
The corruption of every institute, the large scale and small scale corruption of every institution, from banking to the art world to vintage wine to, you know, to
MFA programs, Harvard, MIT, all of it. And you just and it's easy to become extremely cynical about it and to go, this whole system is rotten. And yet, like, you kind of look around. And you think about, I don't know, the wars in the 20th century, how horrific and brutal and just inhuman and anti-human are the establishment. Like, they don't have a great track record.
No.
It's not a kind world.
No.
This world grinds up people like Harford and spits us out. Mm-hmm. And we know it. And one of the articles I was looking at is from somebody, I think it's in Vulture, who watched it 100 times or something like this, and was talking about, it's a film about the price of naivety.
Mm.
How naive are we willing to be? And now, after Weinstein, Epstein, and all of it, and Me Too, and countless others, there's... But especially Epstein.
Yeah.
Like Weinstein is just a clumsy,
he's just a disgusting, power drunk piece of shit.
Yeah. Right.
But Epstein
is scary.
The tentacles are way deeper apparently. Epstein. Yeah.
Yeah. And good old Jizzy, as I like to call her.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. When you know her as well as I do, you call her good old Jizzy.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, that part's interesting to me, because I think probably when this film came out, there was probably like, I mean, some people were probably like, yeah, that's what it's like. And some other people were probably, I imagine there was some reception that was sort of like, well, it's, that's a little over the top, don't you think? The whole ritualistic, blah, 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 blah. And then Epstein comes out and you see that little temple on little St. James Island. And it's like, well, I don't know. I don't know how, you know, I think it's, there's a little, there's some players that are up to some darker stuff than that. So,
yeah, there's a class of person who can just get on the PJ and go.
Yeah.
Where you're just, it's just another level of the evil that allows to just come into your life is just astronomical. Most of us are just landlocked on the little islands inside of our bourgeois, our little marriages. And if we have a little infidelity, it's at a conference or it's maybe through an app and it's sort of pathetic. It'd be
sort
like
tawdry, and
you know. Go to Domino and you know, whatever, you do your thing, you feel guilty about it, you come back home.
Yeah. Right.
This
right,
is the next level shit. When you're like, I got to fly to Vegas for the weekend, honey, I'll meet you in St. Tropez or whatever it is. And like, fucking, you know, and Jeffrey will be there, and then we're gonna go to Little St. James, and then next week we're in Paris. Like, can't you just like, and I'm not this guy, but just, can't you just hear the roaring of like sin? Drugs and anything you want. You want. Most of us don't even have those temptations. We pray to not have those. Like, believe me, I would love. Would I even love to have a private jet? I didn't even know if I would.
I wouldn't. That's what I was saying when we were doing the main episode. When you walked in, like when you walked, and the one hand, like I sort of get, okay, you hear about some salacious sex party and there, I can understand as a human being, there being some draw to that. But as soon as, for me, say I got to that point, as soon as I walked in that door and saw what was going on, I'd be like, oh, fuck this.
I don't want anything to do with this. I'm not gonna name names, but like
I thought we were gonna do cocaine and
I'm really, this is the end of the year. A little break is gonna be very welcome. Like a little week. If you don't hear from us for a little while, we're going on some other podcasts. We post every podcast we go on the website at artofdarkpod.com. We've got a link if you go to the vault on the side there. We've got a guest podcast category. In any case, we'll be around. The way these things go is it's more like kind of semi sleazy guys with money and their girlfriends or women enablers trying to pick up hot young chicks. That's it. You want to come to a party? Oh, what are we going to do? Well, you know, this guy owns a sex boat.
This guy owns a sex boat.
There's sex parties in the sex boat. That's pretty much what it amounts to.
Right.
With much more waltzing in advance, and maybe there's a little cocaine, and maybe there's some drinking, and you start, and a certain number of people will go on the sex boat.
But
what Eyes Wide Shut seems to imply is this marriage of, it's not even libertinism.
Not really.
It's something else that it's implying. It's this level of like the women have to be models. They have to be these just specimen. And it creates this anxiety. There's this anxiety in it that Bill, it goes beyond. It's not even about what is being represented on the screen. It becomes extremely psychological. Like, it's not even about the, it's about the fact that there are so many of them.
Right.
All on display.
Right.
It's all an opulence. Available, but he can't have it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And meanwhile, he has Nicole Kidman at home. He has.
Right. Right.
I mean, he's a perfect 10 in every respect by most measures. You would just go,
and you have a beautiful daughter, but it's not good enough. There's something else out there, and it's about, again, this status anxiety.
Well, yeah, I mean that sort of fear of missing out thing, man. Mm. Like in all aspects of your life, if you let that stuff creep in, it's gonna lead you to do some stuff that you're better off not doing. Right? I mean,
100%. Yeah. All right, I got a little bit about the. This is from Vanity Fair. Eyes Wide Shut at 15, inside the epic secretive film shoot that pushed Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman to their limits. I'm going to read a few paras of this. Kubrick's obsession with secrecy so infected his cast and crew that no one has ever spoken about it in detail. The day-to-day life on set can only be inferred from facts and hints. The most major fact, Eyes Wide Shut was exhausting. Kubrick had asked Cruise and Kidman to commit to 6 months. When they landed in London in the fall of 96, the couple fully expected to return to Hollywood by spring. Instead, they stayed on through the summer, fall, and another Christmas. Filming wrapped in January of 1998. But in May, they were summoned back for more months of reshoots. Together, altogether, they'd spend 15 months on Eyes Wide Shut, the wow. Guinness World Record for the longest continual film shoot.
Really?
That's Guinness. Ah. Wow. Stanley had figured out a way to work in England for a fraction of what we pay here, explained Sidney Pollack, who joined the cast as the corrosive tycoon Victor Ziegler after the extended shooting forced original actor Harvey Keitel to cry uncle and dropped out. While the rest of us poor bastards are able to get 16 weeks of filming for $70 million with a $20 million star, Stanley could get 45 weeks of shooting for $65 million. Though every 6 months Cruise spent in London cost him another $20 million film he wasn't making, plus he had the fledgling Cruise Wagner production company to oversee, he swore to the press he had no qualms about his extended art house sabbatical. I remember talking, and I respect Cruise for that. I remember talking to Stanley and I said, look, I don't care how long it takes, but I have to know, are we going to finish in 6 months? Said Cruise. People were waiting and writers were waiting. I'd say, Stanley, I don't care. Tell me it's going to be 2 years. Kubrick is legendary for his perfectionism. So too bad about all those gaffes and oops we saw.
Yeah, right.
To reconstruct Greenwich Village in London, he sent a designer to New York to measure the exact width of the streets and the distance between newspaper vending machines. But his approach to character and performance was the opposite. Instead of knowing what he wanted on the set, he waited for the actors to seize upon it themselves. His process, repeated takes designed to break down the idea of performance altogether. The theory was that once his actors bottomed out in exhaustion and forgot about the cameras, they could rebuild and discover something that neither he nor they expected. During The Shining, he'd put Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall through 50 takes to figure out what he wanted, causing Duvall to have a nervous breakdown. For Eyes Wide Shut, given his star's extreme pliancy and eagerness to please, nice, that's how I like him, Kubrick went further. Once insisting that Cruise do 95 takes of walking through a door. In times when we couldn't get it, it was just like, fuck, admitted Cruise. I'd bring it upon myself because I demanded a lot of myself. But what he never asked, or at least not openly in the press, was if there was an it Kubrick wanted him to get. After all, a director who demands 95 takes could be exacting, or conversely, he could be ill-prepared and uncommunicative. Cruise's overpreparation had served him well in the past, not here. He got an ulcer and tried to keep the news from Kubrick. At its core, the Cruise-Kubrick combination seems cruel. An overachieving actor desperate to please a never-satisfied auteur, the power balance was firmly shifted to Kubrick, yet to his credit, Cruise has never complained. Kubrick defenders, Cruise included, insist the legend was fully in command. He was not indulgent, Cruise insisted to the press. You know you are not going to leave that shot until it's right. Yet it's hard not to see the indulgence when even small roles demanded prolonged commitments, like starlet Vanessa Shaw's one-scene cameo as a prostitute, which was meant to take 2 weeks and ended up wasting 2 months. Adding to the peril, Kubrick also refused to screen dailies, a practice Cruise relied on. Making a movie is like stabbing in the dark, the actor explained. If I get a sense of the overall picture, then it's better for the film.
Cruise couldn't watch and adjust his performance to find his character's through line, a problem exacerbated by the amount of footage the director filmed. For most of the cast, who appeared only in one or two moments, they had only to match the timbre of their character's big moment. But Cruise alone is in nearly every scene and had to spend the shoot playing a guessing game. Not knowing which of his mind-melting number of takes would wind up in the film, he still had to figure out how to shape a consistent character from scene to scene. Given Kubrick's withholding direction and the exponential number of combinations that could be created from his raw footage, it's understandable if the forever prepared actor found himself adrift. Sure. So it goes on. Here's a little bit from Kidman. Adding to the actor's peril was the part's personal emotional risk. Kubrick decided to find his story through psychoanalyzing his stars, prodding Cruise and Kidman to confess their fears about marriage and commitment to their director in conversations that the three vowed to keep secret. Tom would hear things that he didn't want to hear, admitted Kidman. It wasn't like therapy because you didn't have anyone to say, and how do you feel about that? It was honest and brutally honest at times. The line between reality and fiction was deliberately blurred. The couple slept in their character's bedroom, chose the color of the curtains, strewed their clothes on the floor, and even left pocket change on the bedside table, just as Cruise did at home.
Huh.
Yeah. And that's the Vanity Fair article, and I can go on and read the whole thing, but I'll spare you to read the rest. That's cool. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Underrated film, I think. I fear.
Oh, it's a great film. I was just looking, I was curious what Cruise made sort of before and after this. And the movie he made right before this was Jerry Maguire. And the movie he made right after it was Magnolia. And this was all sandwiched in between two Mission Impossible movies. So very, very interesting. Very, I know we all give Cruise a lot of crap, but he is this figure that we all kind of know. We've all seen a chunk of his films, and it's kind of interesting to see that. Mission Impossible, and then Jerry Maguire, which was a popcorn movie. It's good for what it is. And then Eyes Wide Shut. Kind of, and then back to Mission Impossible. It's very interesting.
You gotta respect that career.
Well, and there's also something interesting too, because I got thinking, and that Tom Cruise's thing is he's practically a stuntman now, right? But like there is a parallel intensity to 15 months with Kubrick and driving a motorcycle off a cliff. Right. Like if there is a similar, if we're going to do this, we're going to fucking do it. Right.
Right.
So it's interesting.
You've gotta admit, I'm going to admit that one, Scientologists and Cruise are based on psychiatry. I think that is interesting. And that take, you can take it or leave it. I think we should be skeptical about a lot of this stuff.
Sure.
So I admire that. The rest of it, you could leave at the door. But I do like free thinkers and contrarians. But I'll say Cruise would be fascinating to, like, if you could just have a normal dinner with the guy.
Yeah, and I feel like there's got to be like a veneer that most people never get past.
Yeah, you would never get past it. But if you could just magically get past it and be like, what was it like working with Stanley in London?
Right.
You know, he probably wouldn't want to talk about it. But let's imagine a scenario, a fictional world where you've just cleared his thetans and he's ready to he's ready to dish. Yeah, what a life. I mean, my God. I mean, just large. He's kind of the last movie star, isn't he?
In a way, he sort of is. Yeah, and I know he's older, but like all of the other sort of movie stars, like Denzel Washington, maybe, or they're all
George
playing
Clooney.
They're all kind of playing older men now. Which is they are older men, but Tom Cruise isn't. Tom Cruise is still kind of playing like 35 year old sort of from a character standpoint, you know.
Yeah.
So he is sort of the last movie star.
It feels like the 80s won't die until Tom Cruise dies.
The first gray hair sprouts on Tom Cruise's head.
Oh, and I'm not wishing death upon Tom Cruise.
No, of course.
It's like he's just this avatar of Americana, and a very interesting career. Like the guy who made Top Gun, he never had to go work with Stanley Kubrick and walk through a door 70 times.
It didn't. I doubt that it helped his career in any way.
Yeah, I mean, really? No, right. Yeah. But I mean, he's at a point where, like, what does that even mean? Like, he's on another planet entirely, which is part of the fun, I think, of this movie is Kubrick putting him in this pressure cooker of a movie and seeing what comes out.
Well, and Kidman too. I mean, she was there too, so let's give her some props.
Oh,
I think
she's
legit, man. Like, I don't think of her that often in my sort of catalog of actors who I think are great, but then every time I see her, and just about every time I see her in something, I'm like, she's really good in this.
You never when Nicole Kidman shows up, you never go, ugh,
right.
Here's another movie with Nicole Kidman.
Right.
And she has that rare combination of just exquisite beauty and authentic talent. Scene.
Yeah, she's not just a pretty face by any means.
No. Yeah. I mean, and then she just totally got naked, like for Kubrick, and it's just the three of them in the bedroom, and
Yeah, imagine she probably had to do that 100 times, right? Take her pants off or whatever.
Only 99 times. Only 99 times. Yeah. I want to say, okay, so enough Eyes Wide Shut, enough Kubrick. Thank you for a good year, my friend.
Yeah,
thank you, Patreon. All our friends, we're going to start new, fresh next year. You know what's coming. Your fans by now, you're listening to the Patreon. We really... appreciate it. We already said that, but I can't say it enough. I watched Ghostbusters Afterlife. Have you seen Afterlife?
Afterlife is not the all ladies Ghostbusters, is it? It's another one after that. I haven't seen it.
Afterlife is the Ghostbusters sequel that the fans wanted.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I got a little verklempt at the end. I really did. Ghostbusters.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I love Ghostbusters. Is like, if I ever want to travel back to my early childhood and remember one of the movies that I fell in love with genuinely as a little kid on VHS, I love Ghostbusters, man. Yeah. And they really did it justice because they had to work around Harold Ramis being dead.
Oh, okay.
And they did it. It was directed by... it was written by and directed by Ivan Reitman's son. So it has the quality of continuity that the all-female Ghostbusters like just went off in this crazy direction that didn't honor the original
vibe.
It's nothing to do with the gender change. I don't care. It didn't honor the original. And this is a tangent, but anyway, man, I really enjoyed it, and I've already watched it two times. And,
oh, wow. Okay. All right.
Yeah, man. And they're kind of playing with like the Stranger Things is such a big hit, right? So it focuses on the kids, and man, it was really cool. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, cool.
Watch Afterlife and let me know what you think. I don't just watch fancy movies.
Oh, you can't just watch fancy movies. Yeah.
All right, man. Well, we've got a banging year coming. We're gonna go take a break, a little tiny break. Let's get who are we gonna do a dark room in January before Conrad? You know who we're gonna have
on? Well, I know we've got a handful of people that we talked about doing episodes with in January, and then I've just been sort of like trying to chill, so I haven't we haven't got him on the calendar.
Good. This is that week in the year which is like a nobody week.
Really gets
like,
done
nothing gets done, everybody kind of pretends. But
Matt Pagus wants to come on and talk about William S. Burroughs. I think we got an interesting talk there, and then Sam Bunce to come on and talk about Gurdjieff. People, if you're on Twitter, if you're active on Twitter, you might not know these people. Matt Pagus is from the New Right podcast, and maybe you don't, and you'll get to meet somebody new. So I think those will be good episodes.
Well, Brad, I want you to walk away from the podcast, go directly to your wife.
Yeah.
Hug her just avoid the mansions in the woods.
Yes. Well, I'm pretty good at that part. So
stay out of the fake Greenwich Village. Stay away from Little St. James. Yeah. And you and everybody on Patreon have a very happy new year. We're coming back season 3.
Yep, happy new year. Talk to you
soon. Happy new year. All right.